Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, whenever you're listening, and welcome to Tri-State at the Plate. I'm your host, Andy Burdick, joined as always by the El Capitan, our super producer, Jason Ruggiero.
Good to be here.
So it's good to be back again this week. This week we're going to kick things off talking a little bit about instant replay in Major League Baseball. All of this generation's techies are super excited about it.
Not this one.
Major League Baseball has decided to expand instant replay for next season. So now we have our point-counterpoint already set up, because I am one of instant replay, I think, has been a long time coming in baseball, and Jason clearly is not. Jason, let's go ahead and hear your side first. So why are you not excited about
it? I hate instant replay.
What is it about instant replay? What gets you
going? They don't get the call right all the time. How many football games have you watched where the guy throws his little red hanky out there and they jog off the field and they're gone for 20 minutes and they come back and like, oh no, yeah, he caught it. Yep, I saw it. And the coach is still mad. The fans are still booing. It doesn't matter.
Well, and we actually had an example of that earlier this year against... It was against your Cleveland, yeah. Or it went in favor of the Indians, didn't it?
Yeah.
It went in the Indians. Was it Ryan Rayburn? Was that who hit that ball?
I'm not sure if it was Rayburn.
Someone for the Indians.
But it was against the A's.
Yeah, they hit a home run that got called a double initially. Isn't that how it happened? They hit a ball that got called a double initially, and then they went and reviewed it? Or did they thought it was fan interference? How did that
happen? They called it a home run, and it wasn't.
And it was clearly below the line on the replay.
Yeah.
So they went back, looked at the replay where the ball clearly hit below the line,
and they
they still called it a home run after that.
But see, and this goes to my problem, because you get something like that, and the camera doesn't always capture everything. And so it's like, maybe in their mind, because a lot of the views I saw of that particular play, the ball changed a direction ridiculously. In only a way it could, you know, by hitting the railing or whatever it
right
hit. But as many replays as I saw, and Lord knows ESPN and MLB Network and Sportstime Ohio and everyone had like 4 million replays of that, none of them actually showed the ball hit. Like, all it was like it jumped a frame.
Right.
Like
it was like really blurry.
Perfectly timed where you never saw the ball hit. You just saw it coming in, and then the next frame it's changing direction.
Yeah.
And that's like what I'm saying, you know, whether it's that or whether it's an umpire that just is still clueless despite having looked at a replay. I don't know. I mean, whatever. It doesn't really matter to me. I just, my opinion of the whole thing is meh.
Like, so you're
it does not excite me in the least to look forward, you know, to look out and see instant replay coming.
Okay, all right. I can understand that. I'm of the mindset that if you can get a call right, I absolutely think you should. And the people that irritate me the most on this. And I was going to see if you were going to get to this, because you were going to be one of those people, but you weren't.
Well,
the people that irritate me the most are the ones that go and kind of take like a defensive stance for the umpires on this. Like, well, how are the umpires going to feel if they have to go in and, you know, feel like their calls are being their every call is under so much scrutiny and they're being questioned? Who cares?
Well, I don't really care about that, but I do kind of sympathize with this view that's come up with all this replay talk about how, like, are umpires really any worse, or is it just the fact that there's like 400 camera angles
to catch
every game, and there's two networks that are 24/7 nonsense,
right?
You know, and they're just like, oh my gosh, he missed the call. This never happened before in the history of baseball. He was actually out and they called him safe. I've never seen it before.
They can analyze everything.
It's like,
to
my god.
Well, and this like, is the other thing I'll say about baseball too, and you know, baseball is very slow to change. But think about how much baseball's evolved over the last, you know, even since its inception, where they started baseball where, you know, you're throwing underhand, you know, evolving to overhand, evolving to mounds, evolving to smaller mounds because Bob Gibson's too good.
I think originally a home run was ungentlemanly.
Yeah.
And when you hit a home run, you had to go get the ball.
Oh, really?
Because it was like, dude, you're not supposed to hit it over the fence.
We're all playing a game.
Like, how am I going to catch it if you hit it over the fence?
That is,
I'm pretty sure that is how it was. I saw a vintage baseball game, I guess.
Yeah.
At Genesee Country Village in New York, one time, and they all like left their gloves out there, you know,
for everyone to use.
The next guy and whatever.
Did they all have mustaches?
Yeah, they did.
Long mustaches.
And like they were explaining the rules, and I'm pretty sure that's the one thing I remember from that whole visit, which. It was like 100 degrees that day and miserable, but
imagine how they felt in those cotton uniforms.
I'm sure, yeah. But I remember them saying that a home run was ungentlemanly.
I like that.
And I think you had to go get the ball, which would make sense because it's like, oh, you're not supposed to do that.
Don't be a jerk. Anyways, I'm on the side of I think more replays good. The only thing I will say about instant replay that I don't like that they've done is giving the...
What you're gonna say.
The managers get the one for the first six innings and then two for the seven innings after that.
It's them going, oh, I don't know what to do. Everybody wants to have replay. Well, football's popular. What do they do?
Yeah. We'll give you some replay here, like, and then a little replay there. What's gonna irritate me the most, and this is what I don't like.
And I know what you're gonna say, and this is one of my big beefs with it. Go ahead.
All right. Here's what I don't want to happen. I don't want it to turn into a strategical thing, which is what's going to happen.
Well, that's going to happen. I thought that will definitely happen. But I thought what you're going to say is what always happens in, you know, like a playoff NFL game where you've got this bunch of schmo refs, like think, you know, of the like Hunter Wendell stat of the NFL, right? And so it's this huge game and you only get two challenges or whatever. And you blow him in the first like quarter because he's made two egregious calls, and then and so to transfer to the baseball, you know, analogy, in the sixth inning or whatever, it's like bases loaded and blah blah blah, and something horrible goes wrong, and you're like, I don't have any challenges.
Yeah,
and that's the thing to me. It's like Pandora's box. Like, it's not gonna solve everything. So, and I'm not saying that's a reason not to do it. But it's just going to be this continual debate for the next.
Oh, it's going to. That's like, going to constant. The rules for challenging these calls in baseball are going to constantly be evolving.
I just don't want to hear it. Like, I don't have the patience for it. Like, that's why to me it's just like.
You're just exasperated by it.
Yeah, I just don't have the patience for replay. I really don't. And then just all these like rules. It's like a college overtime game now in football. Like, oh, well, you get two before this, and then you get one after that. And what are they going to do, too? Are you going to like throw a bag of sunflower seeds on the field?
That's what I'm wondering. I'm kind of curious. I haven't seen anything. All I found in the articles that I've read about it, they say that the managers will have to inform the umpire before the next, you know, pitch. So how they're gonna do that, I don't know. I guess we'll see.
They're gonna take out their wad of gum and then put their spent dip in it, fold it up, and throw it out on the field.
Hurdles would be like a cannonball if he was throwing it out there. That'd be like
every time this year Sports Time Ohio shows Terry Francona in the dugout, he's taking a wad of gum out of his mouth. I can't even imagine what they're spending on bubble gum in that
dugout. That's where your hard-earned ticket money's going.
And I'm not gonna sit here with all of our listeners and accuse him of putting spent dip in that gum, but he's putting something in it. That's all I'm gonna say.
Just he doesn't want the wife to know.
Yeah. Well, he needs to talk to the cameraman then. Because they get him like three times a game on that.
Snitching him out. All right. Well, on today's show, we got a lot to get to. We Jason and I attended some baseball games this weekend, so we're going to be talking about those. So we'll get to the Cleveland Indians right off the bat. We'll move on to what's going on with the Pittsburgh Pirates. Wrap up with the Seawolves shout-out at the end. Jason and I both attended Seawolves games together. I attended some with Bob and then some on my own. So lots of baseball to talk about. So, Jason, let's get this kickstarted right away with Cleveland and what's going on with the Tribe over in Cleveland.
Well, it's actually a pretty good week for Cleveland. They wrapped up a West Coast road trip going 6-3, which that's a solid week. And that's kind of week they needed after kind of struggling for the last few. Dr. Garrett's not here, so I'll run through the injuries real quick. In the good news category, Corey Kluber has progressed to playing catch at 180 feet with a splint on his finger and 90 feet without a splint. So we've got two different things going on there. To me, it seems like once you're throwing without the splint, just throw without the splint. Like, if it's going to hurt, it's going to hurt. I guess, you know, though, it is like twice the distance, so a lot more torque. But Brett Myers is continuing his long slog back. I don't really expect him to do much this year. Josh Tomlin is progressing quicker and is still, you know, on schedule to make a return sometime in August or early September, from what I understand. I believe he pitched in Akron, actually. I think it was the week before. I think it was last week. But he's building his pitch count up, and he's still on track. He's, you know, it's hard to know what it means to have good starts in Double A and things like that when you had a respectable major league ERA. But
right.
It's kind of like, well, at least he's finding the strike zone and not just imploding. You know, that's pretty much all I, when I see like a rehab start, that's what I think of. When I see a bad rehab start, I'm like,
get a little nervous.
I don't know. But when I see a good one, I'm like, well, that's good. At least that went well.
Now what's going on with Ryan Rayburn?
Yeah. Old Rayburn, Mr. Bench MVP, hasn't played since Sunday against the A's because of a sore right calf. And at this point, he's gone almost, well, not quite a week, 5 days almost, without playing. They're obviously trying to avoid a DL stint for him, but it's one of those injuries that kind of makes you wonder a little, because every day it's like, oh, it's getting better. Oh, he could have pinch hit today. Oh, he could have played if I needed him. Oh, you're kind of like, I don't know. Is this really nothing?
Right.
Is what you start to wonder after about a week of that. So we'll see if he plays. This Friday, they start a series with the Twins. So all indications are that he will play in that series, but he's listed as day to day. So that's classic, you know, obfuscation from a team head trainer. Obfuscation and declarification, if you will. Danny Salazar. He had a bad start last week against the Twins after an excellent, excellent start.
It turns out he's human after all.
Yes. But he did pitch well Wednesday against the Angels. He only went 5 1/3 innings, but I'm blanking on the runs he gave up. But when he left, it was, I'll have to look that up. It was a good start. And he was at 75 pitches when they removed him. And Francona said basically that they've come to the conclusion that he's on a pitch count. He's been on a pitch count the last 2 years recovering from Tommy John. But they don't want him to face the middle of the order as he's nearing the end of his pitch count.
Yeah.
Which I think is wise. You know, we saw what happened there with Miguel Cabrera, which, you know, a lot of people, there's mixed opinions of that, but it's kind of like one of those things. Well, one, it's Miguel Cabrera, so
right.
I wouldn't exactly get too upset about getting taken yard by him. But it does show, you know, when he gets to that point, he's not as fine, so he starts overthrowing, trying to make up for that lack of command, and that's probably what they feel when he's more likely to hurt himself than, you know, any other time. And it kind of goes to that idea you hear every once in a while about how pitch count is not so important as intensity of pitches.
Right.
You know, like, did someone like Justin Masterson might go out and throw 120 pitches and throw a complete game, but he just never had runners on base. He breezed through. He just ran up a lot of pitches, whether it was foul balls or wildness or whatever. Or you can have, you know, the kind of like Chris Perez inning, the like Bob Wickman inning, where it's like maybe you only threw 20 pitches, But there were people on base from the moment you walked on the mound. You only had a one-run lead. There were people in scoring position. You know, it's just stressful. Like, and to me, that makes a lot of sense. Like, that those pitches are something to be monitored more closely than just straight number of pitches.
Oh, absolutely. And especially for a starting pitcher, when you figure that a starting pitcher is going to be going from suddenly being able to throw from the windup,
right,
where they probably get a little bit of that extra velocity, a little more, you know, rotation on their breaking balls, to now they're throwing from the stretch.
Right.
You know, they're just putting all that little bit more extra pressure on their shoulders and arms doing that.
And it was interesting, too, because last week, I think it was last week, we had a discussion about, you know, guys like Jeff Locke and skipping them in rotation.
Yeah.
When you get the chance. And Cleveland took that opportunity and this last week and pushed Danny Salazar back a day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the kind of thing that, to me, that's the easiest way to help manage his innings. You know, you skip him when you have an opportunity. You push him back one. If you push him back one day a couple times, all of a sudden, it could save you 10, 15 innings in this last 6 weeks of the season. Their plan, you know, they keep saying, is to keep him in the rotation. I think his performance and Josh Tomlin's performance will go a long way.
Yeah.
In deciding that. In that start against the Angels, he went 5 1/3 and gave up one run and three hits with 7 Ks. So he's got 23 innings pitched and 29 strikeouts. So Indians fans have, you know, good reason to be excited about that. Another interesting thing was Rocky Calavito's name came up this week as Michael Brantley set the Indians' all-time record for errorless games by an outfielder. He broke the Rocks record this Tuesday with 214 consecutive errorless games. Now, there's two interesting things about this. One, the Rock did it over two separate stints with the Indians. Like, he was with the Indians and didn't make an error over that time, left the team, came back, and resumed that errorless streak.
Oh, that's interesting.
Brantley's, of course, was consecutive, you know, seasons. Also, you know, Terry Francona pointed this out, and I think it's interesting. You know, he was saying it's not like some of these outfielders that have errorless streaks because they don't play the position aggressively. You know, they
right.
Like, in a way, I mean, Manny made errors, but in a Manny Ramirez kind of style of outfield,
yeah,
where, you know, you just kind of like get the ball and lob it in most of the time. Like, you're not going to make a lot of errors that way.
Right.
But Michael Brantley is actually tied for the American League lead in assists with 11. So, you know, he's playing an aggressive outfield and not making an error, which makes it even more valuable. So that was interesting. And Terry had some interesting comments about Manny, but that's for another time this week. All the buzz, you know, about Manny getting released, the Indians have had to answer a lot of questions about whether they would be interested in reuniting with him.
His swan song?
Yeah. I don't think so. So anyways, Dice K was released this week.
Oh, downer.
Yeah.
There he goes.
And he actually, you know, I mean, he was pitching well, you know, so that was someone that I thought might make an appearance here as we get into this kind of struggle with this Scott Kazmir, Danny Salazar, dead arm, innings limit, pitch count fiasco.
Right. So you're thinking he might make an appearance. Let me ask you this. How would you have felt had he actually made an appearance for you? The second he steps on that mound, how do you feel as an Indians fan?
Well, let me pull up his stats. I mean, they're actually pretty good in Columbus.
In Columbus?
I mean, he was starting to throw pretty well. And as I put his name into the Google machine, it comes up sources Mets near deal for Dice K.
Ooh.
Not exactly in the playoff hunt there, but
really, really looking to upgrade that roster there.
Mets
in the hunt for Dice K.
Yeah. Let me just, it's not pulling up his minor league stats, but why I get that, we'll get back to Dice K.
Well, and one of the things about Dice K that I think is kind of interesting, and you're seeing a lot of people talk about this with players where, like the Albert Pujols contract and the Josh Hamilton contract, where they sign these huge long-term deals and they're these huge investments for franchises. And then, you know, you're not going to get your money returned on Albert Pujols or Josh Hamilton. I mean, if you win a World Series this season, so let's say the Angels were good enough to win a World Series this year with those players, they still have another 9 years of Pujols and another, you know, 4 years of Hamilton or whatever it is. And I feel like with international players too, at some point, there's got to be that correction where you're going to see teams that are going to start shying away from those, I would assume. That's a huge investment for Boston. I don't know off the top of my head how much money they spent up front to get Dice K.
It was like 50. But
it was, I was going to say, I thought it was like 50 million.
Yeah.
You know, just to
posting.
Right. To talk to him and have the chance to negotiate with him.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming at some point you're going to see teams stop doing things like that too, when they realize the amount of risk and how much it can hurt a free. I mean, it can really hamstring a franchise if you miss on a player like that.
I agree with that. And for a team like Boston or Pittsburgh or Cleveland, like, it's just not realistic. But, you know, like, Yu Darvish is going to inspire these big market teams to just flush.
That's why I'm kind of curious to see what happens with Jose Abreu, the new Cuban defector. To see what goes down with him, whether this Puig mania and Yu Darvish, kind of like you said, whether teams are going to want to invest in that, or whether, and I think it is kind of like you said, where the big market teams that can throw money around are just going to say, all right,
yeah, I'll give it a try.
What, $50 million, let's do it.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. And I think, you know, like, you look at Yoenis Cespedes, I mean, the man has prodigious power, as was on display at the Home Run Derby. But isn't he hitting like 230?
Yeah, 220. Just,
I mean, like, I'm sorry.
He's making Pedro Alvarez look good.
Like, that's the thing. If you want somebody that can hit like 40 bombs and hit 220, those guys are all over the minors, man. Like, call Jack Cust out of retirement.
And I just mean, tell him, swing for the fences.
But seriously, you know, like, 230 with a lot of power, you can get that for not $50 million. Like, Billy Beane can't be happy with this season he's getting from Cespedes.
Oh, absolutely not.
But anyways, Dice K, his last start was bad. He went 4 innings and gave up 5 runs. But previous to that, his last, I'm looking at it, like 6 starts, he went 6 to 8 innings and gave up 1 run in all of them but 2. So his cumulative numbers, he was 5-8 with a 3.92 ERA, 39 walks and 95 strikeouts.
If I were an Indians fan, I'd still be feeling better that he wasn't on the mound pitching for me in games that could potentially matter.
Right, except, so, but look at who's going to replace him. Like, if Josh Tomlin comes up, I think it's at least a wash. You know, if it's good Josh Tomlin, if it's good little cowboy, it's like a 3. If it's bad, it's like a 5, which is probably what those numbers equate to of Dice K's in the majors. But if it's not Josh Tomlin, it's Trevor Bauer, it's Carlos Carrasco, which they could go out there and spin a shutout for 9 innings, or they could just like walk the bases loaded in a merry-go-round for 2 innings too. Like, and then Carrasco would get mad and bean someone again, and then things would spiral out of control, you know?
Who knows what you're getting?
I don't know. We'll move on from Dice K. I think we've talked about that more than needs to be discussed.
Let's move on to something a little more positive with Nick Swisher.
Yeah, Nick Swisher. I think he's like feeling all this like negative air around him from all these Indians columnists. There's all these articles talking about how his contract is a bust. It's 1 year.
Right.
And he's been hurt. Now, if he comes back next year and he has shoulder problems again, okay, now it's like, uh-oh, we got this guy for 2 more years and he can't get healthy. But he had his 15th home run of the season last night against the Angels. It was his second of the Angels series. And I thought there was an interesting quote by Swish in The Plain Dealer where he was basically saying, like, I've been struggling with my shoulder all year, and we're in the home stretch now, so I'm just cutting it loose. And he didn't specifically say whether, like, oh, my shoulder's feeling better, so I'm just cutting it loose. It was almost like, I don't have to baby it now because I only got a month left in the season.
Right.
So I'm just
letting it rip.
Letting it rip, man. I don't know if, you know, like, in some ways, I guess that's good because it's like, well, it tells you that it has been the shoulder. You know, he's been trying to baby his shoulder and not it all started with that big cut he took that night I was at the game against the Nationals. I could see it on his face from that mezzanine, the look of pain from that swing. So, you know, I think it's like he doesn't want to do that again.
Right.
And if you look at his splits, that big cut came when he was batting left-handed. His right-handed numbers are just right in line with his career, and his left-handed batting numbers are poor. So it's like when he's trying to get any power out of his, would be his right shoulder, he's babying it. Which makes sense, too, because they're trying to not play him in the outfield.
Right.
So it's all that right shoulder related, you know. So, I mean, I don't know if he's going to have surgery. Nobody's talking about that. But it's good to see him hitting again. It's good to see Santana and Cabrera wake up a little as well. And that's the thing. If this offense gets clicking at all and the starting pitching, like, holds on. And that's about where I am with the starting pitching. Like,
just
hold on. Like,
just don't blow up.
Well, and because it's like you got to get Kluber back and hope that he's healthy.
Right.
You've got to hope Salazar can hold out. Hope something happens with Kazmir. Either he can hold out or Tomlin can come up. What something?
Yeah.
You know, but it's just hold on. And then this road trip, the bullpen, it's something like 5 earned runs in almost 35 innings on this road trip. And the other night they had a 14-inning game against the Angels that they ended up winning, where the bullpen threw 8 2/3 scoreless.
Got your money's worth out of that bullpen.
That's the thing. Like if the bullpen can come around, man, and these guys like Swish and Santana Cabrera can just hit a little, like that's all they need.
Right.
That's all they need. And their schedule is so weak. They have an upcoming series with the Orioles, one with the Tigers and one with the Braves. And after that, it's all like White Sox, Royals, Twins, Houston. And the other thing to keep in mind, as we're trying to chase some of these teams, there's a lot of interplay between the teams in the wild card hunt.
Yeah.
So like those games are going to jump like crazy. You know, like 4 games when 2 teams play one another is nothing.
Goes by quick.
And these teams are playing each other a lot down the stretch. But just real quick, we're going to talk more about the Seawolves game. Yeah. and seeing the Arrows players that we saw. But I do want to mention that Francisco Lindor, he's been out of action for the last week with a sore back. He suffered the injury, rested it, returned. It flared up on him again. There's no indication that it will need surgery, but there is a little bit of a rumor that he might be done for the year. Of course, you have to remember, done for the year in Double A is like
12 games, probably
a week or two. Yeah. So it's not, we're not talking like, what, he won't be healthy till October? They're shutting him down? Like, right. Well, no, he won't be healthy till September.
Right.
And that's like 2 weeks
away. The last week and a half of the season.
Yeah. So, and when you've got a guy like that, it's like, why risk it?
Exactly. I will say, though, it was disappointing. He's like a unicorn, man. He's tough for me to catch.
Yeah.
This is like 4 games I've gone to. I think I've only caught him on the field once, where he's had like days off randomly, or, you know, these last 2 games I went to, he was out of commission.
He's a mystical creature.
He's the mythical Francisco Lindor. So is that it? We want to save everything else for when we get to the
Seawolves. We'll
talk
about the Arrows later. I mean, Joey Wendell, personal favorite of me and Bob's, he's continuing to have a great season. Hit another home run. I think he's tied for the lead on the Mudcats with home runs. And this is a guy out of Westchester, not a big college prospect. He's continuing to hit really well. I don't know that, you know, the season winding down, that he's going to get promoted to Akron, but I would expect him to be there next year.
Right. One last thing I wanted to touch on with the Indians before we moved on Twitter. The other day, Clint Frazier and Francisco Lindor are apparently BFFs now, because Clint Frazier tweeted Francisco Lindor something along the lines of, "Hey, want to go get some ice cream and a burger?" And this is at like 2 a.m. So
does that mean Lindor's out in Arizona? Because that's where
I'm assuming
Frazier
that's
is.
I'm assuming that's where he has to be. And Lindor said, "Sorry, man, I'm already in tonight. Maybe we'll get together tomorrow." I think it was super cute to see those guys being BFFs, going to get milkshakes together.
I should mention Clint Frazier continuing to show tons of power. Just
how excited are you about Clint Frazier?
Now, one thing that's been coming up, he has like his strikeout to walk is like 5-1.
Right.
He's 18.
Right. Super small sample too.
Super small sample. And when someone is ripping balls like that, you know, it's kind of this question. I'm not saying this is the direction he's going to end up, because I think he has much more potential to be a more complete player. But it's like, no one complains too much about, you know, like Adam Dunn striking out all the time, like
exactly,
hitting tons of home runs. And when you have an outfielder who's just raking the ball when he's 18 years old.
And it's not like he's Adam Dunn build.
No.
He's super athletic.
I'm just saying, even if it comes to a little bit of a strikeout trade-off, it's just when you draft someone because of power and then they go show that power.
That's exciting.
That's what you want, you know? Like, you worry about the other things later.
Right.
What would be concerning if he's out there not squaring the ball up.
Exactly.
Which is completely not the case.
Super exciting. I'm excited for you guys with him. The Jinja Engine.
Yes.
Okay. Well, yeah, we'll move on and we'll talk about the Seawolves and the Arrows series in a minute. Real quick, we'll touch on what's going on in Pittsburgh before we get to that, though. I have to bring this up because I know Jason's been wanting me to talk about it for weeks now.
Yes,
and I know he's
got
a big smile on his face right now. Stetson Alley is no longer mashing since he was promoted to Bradenton.
No.
It's not, and he's not even performing awfully, like god awfully poorly. You know, he went from a 1.02 OPS to now he's at 714 OPS. He's come back down to earth. He's hitting 227 in Bradenton with 4 home runs. He's striking out at about the same, 37 walks to 74 strikeouts. You know, in West Virginia it was 36 walks to 79 strikeouts, so those numbers aren't really changing.
Yes.
So that's not where the problem's arising. I think it's just the matter of now you're up another level with pitchers that are just a little bit smarter, a little bit savvier. Maybe they've have, you know, some pitches that are better developed than you saw down in West Virginia. So that jump from West Virginia to Bradenton hasn't been kind. But the other thing that you have to remember is, you know, this is only his really second season as a hitter.
Right.
And he's up in Bradenton already at 21 years old. So it's not like he's far behind. You know, he's starting out right. As a hitter, he's right where he should be right now.
Right.
In high A at 21. So, yeah, but it's a little little depressing that his average isn't sitting at that nice 324.
You're doing a good job spinning it right now, but I can see the sadness.
You can't see the sadness on the radio, but I am a little sad about that. So hopefully he comes out next year and just hits 55 home runs and then you just rub your face in it.
55.
So Pittsburgh,
I don't think that's gonna happen.
Pittsburgh just finished a series in San Diego. They're moving on to San Francisco tonight. They really needed that series in San Diego to kind of play out how it did. They went out and they won 2 out of 3 in San Diego after losing 2 out of 3 to both St. Louis and Arizona, which that's tough because kind of like you said, Arizona's that one of those wild card teams chasing that wild card spot, and St. Louis obviously is right now, they're 2 games behind Pittsburgh. So
I think they're 1 now.
Well, after today.
Well, last night they were 1. I think.
Were they? I think they're 2 right now. I don't know. We'll go double check that. But either way, you know, it's a tough series to, you know, 2 consecutive series like that. So that was nice for them to go out and at least take the series from San Diego. So like I said, they're starting in San Francisco tonight. That's a 10:05 start. So hopefully right around the time that we're posting this, the game will be getting started. Now, one of the things I wanted to bring up, and I wanted to get your opinion on this too, was Francisco Liriano and his Cy Young candidacy. Because right now, Liriano is sitting at 100 and... Let me pull it up here just so I have the exact number. But he's sitting at 100 and...
St. Louis is 1 game behind Pittsburgh.
Are they
right
one
now?
Game? Okay.
And Cincinnati is 2.
He's at 121 innings on the year.
Just to clarify, when I say Cincinnati is 2, they are 2 games behind.
2 games
not
behind.
Also 1.
Not also 1 game behind.
Okay, so Liriano.
Liriano at 121 innings. So you figure coming down this last, you know, month of the season, he's probably got 5 starts left. So we'll say maybe he throws another 30, 35, you know, maybe 40 innings. So let's say he gets up into that 150, 160 innings pitched range. If he pitches as well as he has all season long and gets up to that 160 innings pitched, is that enough for people to consider him seriously as a Cy Young candidate, do you think?
My feeling is the question consider or win?
How about both?
Consider, yes. Win, no.
You don't think so?
No. I mean,
the real problem for him is Clayton Kershaw pitches in the same league as him.
That's
which
one problem.
That's his biggest problem.
That's one problem, definitely. The other problem is what is the most useless pitching category?
Wins.
And I'm looking at the NL leaderboard. That's the only one he's even on the top five. He's actually number one, which, again, not all the writers are going to use, you know, that will be an important stat to some writers.
Right.
But what is his ERA?
It is, his ERA on the year right now is 2.53.
I don't know why he's not showing up in this earned run average then.
You know why? Because he doesn't have it's probably sorted by
it's
eligible.
Got a qualifier.
Yeah.
Well, so there you go. Kind of answered your own question. Now, I think he should either win or at least get strong consideration. I don't follow the National League, you know, as closely as you do, but to me, he's a really strong candidate, obviously, for comeback player of the year.
Right.
I mean, to go from nothing to leading the league in wins, a 2.5-something ERA. Yeah. So, personally, I would say he probably should get some votes, but I don't think he really has a realistic chance of winning, mainly because, like you said, he's got to compete with Clayton Kershaw.
Matt Harvey.
If that wasn't enough, he's got Matt Harvey and Fernandez.
Yeah.
Not that Fernandez would win, but... Oh, I guess what I'm saying is, I think most people would vote for Fernandez ahead of Liriano.
Yeah, just even if you took Kershaw out of the whole thing.
Yeah, that's not even counting Harvey. Problem with those two is they're not on teams that really are
mattering.
Yeah. So, are relevant. You know, sometimes that plays a big role with writers.
Right. Oh, absolutely. The narrative is huge.
But Wainwright is there, lurking right behind Liriano and ERA. So, and tied with him for wins.
Yeah.
And third in strikeouts. And, you know, that's what I'm saying. So, I think it's a great season for him, but I don't foresee any realistic chance at winning it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's what I was looking for. That's I wanted to get your opinion on that. I'm kind of actually of that ilk. I think that
I don't think he's done enough. As crazy as that sounds.
Oh, no,
it hasn't been long enough.
I agree wholeheartedly. I'm huge on innings pitched. I think if the more value, the more innings you're able to pitch, the more value you have, which is why, right, I think starters are so much more valuable than relief pitchers, which is why I have a hard time accepting a relief pitcher as a Cy Young candidate. Yeah. Because I think a guy that throws 200 innings with a 3.8 ERA is more, and probably WAR would actually play that out. I'd be curious to look at that. But a guy who throws 200 innings with a 3.8 ERA is going to be more valuable than a guy who throws 75 innings with a 2.95 ERA.
Yeah, right.
Just because that guy's out there for 200 innings, you know, just taking all that pressure off there. So I'm kind of that, where if you have a guy that's going out there throwing 200 plus innings, putting up, you know, equally good numbers, even if they're behind in some other categories, you know, I still think they're probably a better candidate, you know, for whatever award, right, you want to give out. I just think they're more valuable. So
that's the thing. Like, you look at, you know, like I'm saying, okay, so forget Harvey and Fernandez because they're not on teams,
contending teams,
races. You still have Kershaw, and without Kershaw you got Wainwright, and like, as you start to go through these stats, he's tied with him in wins, third in strikeouts, first in strikeouts per walk, second in innings pitched, first in complete games, tied for first in shutouts. Like,
right,
those are the guys that are gonna,
when you start digging deeper, yeah, you start seeing that the innings do kind of matter,
right, because he's racking things up,
right. But like you said, it's still a great season either way. And
it's,
I think,
an amazing season.
I think Liriano's easily going to be the comeback player of the year in the National League. So I don't, if someone else thinks that there's a better player for the comeback player of the year, please tweet at us or email us and let us know. But I think Liriano is pretty much the clear cut, going to be the clear cut favorite for that. So moving on to a little more negative news, Felix PA is playing left field lately as Starling Marte deals with his hand injury. He has a contusion, which this all started in Colorado when he was hit on the hand. And the day that they pulled him out of that game and then they sat him the next day, I said they should just put him on the DL now. Don't fiddle around with this, because now that you're playing him intermittently, you can't even backdate this to retroactively place him on the DL. That's going to irritate me if he ends up going on the 15-day DL and now we have it backdated for 2 days when it should have been, you know, 2 weeks to begin with.
That's I don't have a problem like with trying to wait out an injury like this Rayburn thing. But don't play the guy.
Right.
Like, wait it out.
Yeah.
You know, give him some reps before the game, before you put him in. And when he's like, no, I can't go,
then stick him on the shelf.
Like, okay. You know, but now, like you said, you give him a chance to play. Now you just wasted a whole week of sitting.
Exactly. So, I mean, and Felix PA, honestly, I don't think he's that bad of a guy if you have to play him for 2 weeks. He's going to give you good defense. He's got a really strong arm. He's not going to offer a whole lot else. But
in some ways, he might be someone you might want to consider for right field.
Relative to who we have been playing there?
Yes.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I would probably consider people off the street for that right field position.
That's what I'm saying. Like, so he hits 240. At least he can play good defense.
Good defense,
and he's
great
got a
arm.
Killer arm. He can throw people out from right field. I mean, he's got the arm of a right fielder.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd maybe
he'll stick.
Throw him in there. Let's make this triumvirate a quadumvirate. I don't know what you call for, but that's Snyder, Tabata.
I'm just saying, you
PA,
know.
PA, let's throw everybody out there.
Maybe he'll stick around once Marte's healthy.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll be curious to see how Pittsburgh. I mean, they've been shuffling their roster around a lot, calling up guys because they've been taxing their bullpen. You know, we had Chris Johnson up the other day who threw, you know, he had a phenomenal game the other day. And then, you know, immediately right after that, we optioned, you know, Chris Johnson back down, and then we bring up Ryan Reed back up to eat some more innings, and we're just
the old shuffle.
Those poor guys in the bullpen are just, they're exhausted. They're like, hey, get us some help. We need some reinforcements. So I'll be curious to see how they start shuffling around the roster as these days come up. I know that when they expand it to the 40-man roster, that's going to be great for Pittsburgh, because finally some guys are going to get a breather down the stretch when they're probably going to need it the most. So another thing I wanted to talk about, and you can kind of chime in with who you think you know, these kind of players are, but I want to talk about team MVPs and team MVPs respective to our clubs that we've been watching. And for Pittsburgh fans, I think it's pretty easy to say that if you were looking for team MVP, you could say, hey, oh, Andrew McCutchen, he's having a great year. You know, he's going to be in the league MVP discussion right at the end of the season. But for me, and I said this, you know, a few weeks ago, for me, I really think the team MVP this season has been Russell Martin. I think Russell Martin has been such an upgrade relative to what we had at catcher last year with that disaster of Rod Barajas allowing 93 of 99 base runners to steal against him. But having Russell Martin back there, who's having one of his greatest defensive seasons statistically.
Which he's not like a killer defensive catcher.
No, he's had
historically.
Right. He's had one amazing season and then just average to right around average
I'm just
defensive
saying,
seasons.
You know.
Right.
It's how good of a defensive season he's. I'm not arguing that he's having a great defensive season. He is. How good of a defensive season he's having is a little
fishy to you. You don't like it?
It's just an anomaly. Like, I don't know. Maybe he'll do the same thing next year.
Yeah.
Maybe as he gets older, he's going to become a better defensive catcher.
Could happen.
As I say it, it sounds completely...
sounds crazy. But, I mean, he's put up one really good season back in, I think if you go look, it's at 2007 was his best defensive season based on the statistics that we're looking at right now, which we'll get into in a sec. But actually, that was 2007 was his best defensive season prior to this. So, and he's had a couple, like I said, a couple average seasons, a couple above average seasons, but nothing quite like this. And we're going to start looking at the defensive statistics and why. But in September 2011, Matt Fast wrote an article for Baseball Prospectus stating in a study that he conducted that Russell Martin saved 71 runs by framing.
Okay. I like that.
Okay. And he had the second most strike three calls by on framing pitches like that.
Mm-hmm.
He was only second to Yadier Molina on the list at that time. So you're assuming that that's probably a skill that hasn't eroded. I would assume that
that would stick.
Right.
It's not like blocking a ball where you
need physical.
I think as you're getting older, you can still frame a pitch, perhaps right. better actually.
So you kind of have a baseline for something that he's good at that there's not a whole lot of.
Mm-hmm.
I guess there's not a whole lot of attention paid to catchers that do that, especially for casual fans. You know, people that watch baseball intently.
It gets them wound.
Right. They understand there's value in that. So you have that baseline there with framing pitches. Also, according to FanGraphs, there's some stats that they keep track of called... One's called stolen base runs saved, which is represented by RSB. And it's a zeroed statistic, so it's based on zero being league average. Like guy that was called up from AAA.
So Lou Marson could get a zero.
He'd be a league average catcher, right? So five, if you had a plus five in this statistic, you would be an excellent player with this
right.
stolen base runs saved. So based on that statistic, stolen base runs saved, which measures how many runs a catcher contributes to their team by throwing out runners and preventing runners from attempting to steal, you know, bases in the first place, Russell Martin is plus +8 this season.
Woo, buddy.
So if we're saying plus +5 is excellent according to FanGraphs,
he's off the charts.
Plus +8 this season. So that kind of gives you an idea of the type of season that Russell Martin is having. And you can go look at his numbers and see. I mean, he's throwing out runners at a career record clip this season. So
you're making a good case for MVP here.
Now, hang on, because we're digging a little deeper here. Oh, we're going further down that Ben Jedlicek would love me as I was doing this research. So another statistic that they keep track of over at FanGraphs is catcher blocked pitches. It's also called past pitch runs. It's okay. represented with RPP. And
so this seems like something that could deteriorate to me as you get older.
Yes. It calculates the number of runs above or below average that a catcher is at blocking pitches. So you think the older you get, you know, the slower you're going to be getting.
The knees get creaky.
Unless you're Ivan Rodriguez and you're already right there on the ground. You don't have a whole lot of distance falling down to block those. So RPP is the same type of statistic. It's a zeroed statistic, so zero would be your league average. You know, going all the way up to five would be your excellent, and, you know, anything above that would be great. Russell Martin, his past pitch runs is 4.4 this season. So nice. He's right up there in that excellent area as well with that statistic. So I think combined with all of his offensive contributions, coupled with his defensive contributions, you know, again, based on what we had last season with Rod Barajas, you know, we've got Russell Martin who's out there right now. He's got 11 home runs. He's stolen 9 bases. He's walking, you know, 11% of the time. He's having a great season.
Yeah, sounds like
it. I would make a case that Russell Martin is Pittsburgh's team MVP this season.
And yeah, I can dig that.
With all those statistics I've laid out there for you, if you don't disagree with me, come at me with your best. Come at me with your best. Because I think I've got it right there.
I'm not coming at you.
You're on board with me?
I'm on board with that.
All right. Air pound. I respect that. So how about with the Tribe? Who would you say the Tribe team MVP is?
Well, you know.
Not to jump back to Cleveland, but I'm kind of curious now.
I think the obvious choice, of course, is the J.K. kid, Kipnis. You know, I think he's like kind of the Andrew McCutchen choice of the Indians.
Yeah,
like
the easy one.
The easy choice. If you want to go for the deeper choice, you know, I'm a huge Michael Brantley fan. He's been a rock. He's like the one guy that
he is old faithful,
gone cold. You know what I mean?
Right.
And like, I mean, you're talking about a guy who can like, oh, well, we bat him third today, bat him fourth today, bat him fifth today, bat him sixth, seventh. I mean, you could bat him anywhere. You could bat him leadoff.
Right, and you
he'd hold his own. I think other candidates for that kind of like under the radar might be like a Justin Masterson. He's had the kind of year you were hoping he was going to have again.
Last year.
Well, you know, because he had that one just amazing year.
Right.
And then last year he really scuffled. And so this year he's put out a great season. He hasn't quite become that like ace everyone is always clamoring about. Oh, you need an ace. But he is becoming, you know, a very, very solid pitcher.
Yeah.
You know, you could throw a Yan Gomes out there. I mean, he's been...
I love me some Yan Gomes. I think Yan Gomes is great.
He's been that guy that has...
My Yan Gomes, my case against Yan Gomes versus everybody else relative to who your team MVP would be, though, would be the same case I'd make for Francisco Liriano, yeah. Where, for whatever reason, Cleveland was just not sold on him at the beginning of the season. So, you know, they kind of kept him... He was down in Columbus to start the year, wasn't he, before they called him up.
Before and Morrison got his head pushed back into his chest cavity.
Just before
cavity.
He got railroaded. So, I would make that same case where he probably isn't going to have the at-bats.
But. Ryan Rayburn.
Rayburn, yeah.
15 home runs coming off the bench.
Right, because, in a bench role. Here's something interesting about Michael Brantley, and now that you brought up Brantley, I kind of think I'm on board with that. Michael Brantley has hit from every spot in the lineup this season.
There you go.
Every spot, first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth. He has 2 plate appearances from the ninth spot in the order.
Yep.
Interesting. Michael Brantley, versatile. And we'll get back to it a little more because Brantley's he's going to be coming up in our Seawolves discussions as kind of a comp later on. So we'll get back to Michael Brantley in a little bit. But finishing up with Pittsburgh, just a couple things. Gerrit Cole could be moving to the bullpen before the season's end, according to the organization. Might save some innings there, I guess. I don't know. I'm not a big fan of that, so I don't really want to talk a whole lot about it. But that's how they're going to do it. So whatever.
Oh.
I'm assuming they talk to a lot of doctors. And that's what the doctors have said is the best course of action. So just go ahead and do it, Pittsburgh. Do it and don't learn anything from what happened to Washington last year, please. Expanding rosters. Rosters will be expanding coming up here pretty soon. And I think that's going to be, like I said earlier, great for Pittsburgh, where you're going to see some more guys that
will be
kind of take some pressure off the overly taxed bullpen.
Games are going to get a lot longer here.
Yeah, there's going to be guys coming. Oh, we're going to have We're gonna get our money's worth out of the bullpen definitely when we have all those guys up here. So I think that'll be good. It'll give some guys some much needed rest in that bullpen. The other thing about rosters expanding, and I don't understand why baseball does things like this. I know baseball does things like this because they've always done things like this. That's why baseball does everything that they do, because
it's
just the way it's been forever.
This is the way we've always done
it. So we'll just keep doing it this way, even though it doesn't make any sense. But you think about rosters expanding at the most important time of the season, at the end of the year. All of a sudden, you get this influx of players.
Oh, you get 15 extra guys.
Where you're like, here you go, have fun. Just make sure you tell us which of these guys you want to play. Today
Jason Giambi gets a hit in the first inning and you pinch run for him,
yeah,
because you got like 8 guys on your bench.
Well, and you know, lineups are, you still, I'm pretty sure the way that when the rosters expand, the way it works is you still have to have 25 people on your roster,
right,
declared for that game.
But you can, like, you know, so in this case you could have no one who was in your bullpen the night before.
Exactly. I mean, you can really start messing around with your lineups like that and absolutely start. And why does baseball do that? I would understand if you did it maybe at the beginning of the year when you don't have a clear idea of how the pictures are going to shake out, you know, like where divisions are going to be won and lost and things like that. But you're doing this at the end of the year. I don't understand. I don't understand why that's the time where you want expanded rosters where these players can possibly potentially have the most impact at the end of the year like that. I don't know. Doesn't make sense to me. It's a weird thing, but whatever, baseball. Just do what you do, baseball.
They will anyways.
Yeah. So that's going to wrap it up for the Pirates today. That's basically all we have going out of Pittsburgh. Like I said, they're starting a series against San Francisco tonight at 10 o'clock. So make sure you guys watch this upcoming series and then the next couple and keep a close eye on the race because it's getting tight. It's tight like that hose you can't get unscrewed in your backyard. That's tight. That's screwed to the faucet. That's how tight it's getting.
All right.
You can't get it off there because your hands are all wet because the hose is leaking water. That's how tight it is.
Okay.
All right. Let's move on to the Seawolves because we got a lot to talk about with the Seawolves too. So let's have a real quick Seawolves shout out. Well, your Erie Seawolves played consecutive series against the Pittsburgh Pirates AA affiliate, the Altoona Curve, as well as the Cleveland Indians AA affiliate, the Akron Arrows.
That's right.
we had a chance to go to games in both of those series. I attended the last game of the Altoona Curve series. Got to see some Pirates players, some Pirates prospects that I was really excited to see. Got to see Gregory Polanco. I got to see Alan Hansen, our shortstop. I got to see Alex Dickerson in the outfield. Adalberto Santos, who I love. I just love Adalberto Santos. Has such a great approach at the plate. Like he's fun to watch. He's one of those like not sexy prospects. You know, he doesn't hit for a lot of power and he's not like super fast, but just great plate discipline. I think he's a lot of fun to watch. So we got to watch all those guys. We have write-ups on the website. You can go check them out and you can see videos. We're getting a little bit better with the videos. I thought the iPhone records in 1080p. And I'm thinking, this is great. Well, when you upload from your phone, you don't get great video quality. So we're tinkering around with the videos. We're getting a little bit better with that. So you can go check out some of the videos, some of the players that we watched. But Gregory Polanco, when I saw him, immediately the first thing I thought of was Vladimir Guerrero. Gregory Polanco is all arms and legs.
That's a good comp.
He's all arms and legs. The first time I saw Vladimir Guerrero, he came to PNC Park for an interleague series when he was with the Angels, and it looked like his knuckles were just going to be dragging on the ground. His arms were so long. He uncorked a throw from right field, and you're just like, his arm, it's like a catapult. I mean, it was amazing to see that, and that was kind of who Gregory Polanco reminded me of, just seeing he glides down the base path and in the outfield. I mean, it looks like 10 steps, and he's the first base out of the box. He was a really, really enjoyable player to watch. So if you get a chance over the last couple of days of the AA season, go check him out. We got to watch a couple Seawolves players as well that we've been keeping eyes on all season. Ramon Cabrera, we've mentioned he's back in AA Erie as well. And I've noticed a distinct change in his swing from the beginning of the season. From the beginning of the season, he had a much more aggressive, kind of hitchy type swing, where when I started watching him after he got promoted to Toledo and then sent back down to Erie, his swing is much smoother. It's much more in control. And Ramon Cabrera is one of those guys where he's probably never going to be that great, amazing prospect, but I think he has a chance to be a really solid contributing player. He's one of those guys, great approach at the plate, doesn't strike out a lot, walks a ton. Over his last 10 games, he has something like a .476 on base percentage. And on the season, his on base percentage is at like .363, right around there. So, and he generates a lot of power in his swing. You know, he hits the ball hard. It's just not leaving the park. He only has one home run this season, but he's a lot of fun to watch because he has a great approach. And like I said, you know, now that he's kind of changed his swing, I'll be curious to see how that translates next season. So after Altoona came into town, then we had an opportunity to see Akron.
Arrows, yeah.
And I went to the second game of the series.
Game, yep.
Monday was on a Buck Night, so Buck Nights, things get a little too rowdy there on Buck Nights for me. Can't
well,
do
I
it.
Believe that was the long one on Buck Night.
Yeah.
14 inning affair.
And so I went on Tuesday. And I got to watch all the Akron prospects. I got to see, and I'll kind of let you touch on these guys because you got to see them the last game of the series, but I kept a close eye on Tyler Naquin.
And he hit a home run.
He hit, and it was a really nice swing that he put on the ball too. And I noticed two distinct differences between his swing the first day that I went and versus the second game that I went to, which was the final game in that series with you. The first game that I went to, Naquin had a really patient approach at the plate. I don't think he swung at one first pitch that whole game.
Right.
I think he saw, I wrote it in the article,
like
I think 18 pitches.
Yeah.
He saw between his four at-bats, between his four plate appearances that day. You know, really patient. That wasn't necessarily the case when we went yesterday.
No. I don't know if that has something to do with the Seawolves pitcher, because, man, Jesus Aguilar looked bad yesterday at the plate, too.
Oh, my God. He was chasing
swinging at stuff
everything.
Off his shoe tops.
Soft and away and in the dirt, Aguilar was swinging
it. Oh, my goodness. So I don't know, you know, I mean, I don't know if that was like the Seawolves pitcher was, I'm drawing a blank.
It was not, hang on, I'll pull
that
up.
While you pull that up, I don't know if he was throwing some stanky Uncle Charlie's up there.
And his velocity sat, the Seawolves pitcher, his velocity was sitting at 90, 92. I mean, he wasn't.
But he was dropping curves in that were like right around
like 79 mile an hour. Yeah. Breaking balls.
So that's, you know, big. He's got a nice change of pace there.
Right.
But yeah, we saw Carlos Moncrief, who's a up and coming, I guess is how you classify him, Cleveland prospect. He's actually had a really rough last 10 games heading into the Akron Erie series. I think he was hitting like 160 or something coming in those last 10 before. You saw him go 1-for-4 and hit a monster home run.
He destroyed that ball. It was one of those where if you weren't watching the game, the second you heard that ball hit the bat, you were looking up to see what happened.
Well, yeah, and I can tell you that the night we were both there last night, he had two hits, so he's kind of coming out of this slump, which is nice to see. But every one of those hits, even this, I think one was just like a ground ball up the middle. It had just a distinct sound.
He squared him up.
Like, holy cow. So that was interesting. Although we did kind of make note that while he looks good on the bases, he looks a little slow in the outfield. You know, it doesn't show up so much on the bases, but there were a couple balls in the corner, or at least lining, you know, kind of fading towards the corner that it looked like he should have been able to get to. He does have a good arm, but it seems like he's a little slow. Tyler Naquin, like you said, he had a rough night at the plate last night. He did make a play in the outfield, kind of running over the shoulder, diving catch as he like slid onto the warning track just about.
Yeah.
It brought some discussion among the TSM crew. Bob just was overall impressed with it, whereas you and I, and we were in different vantage points, so that may have had something to do with it. He may be more right, we may be more wrong, or the other way, I don't really know.
No, we're definitely more right.
Did you watch it on MLB?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I went back and watched it.
Yeah. His feet got crossed up.
And it was, and actually the way that Bob described it makes sense, because Bob is watching the at-bat. Bob was sitting right behind home plate, so he got to see everything straight on,
which we've been straight on with Naquin, who's in center.
Exactly. And when we got to watch, the first thing that I noticed was
he turned the wrong way.
He's not running the right way. He's running back, and it's almost like his chest is still facing. Like, he almost looked like he wanted to turn and flip around the other direction, but he realized if he did that, there was no way he was going to get to the ball. And so he just kind of kept running at the awkward angle that he was running at the end, leapt over his shoulder and made a phenomenal catch. I mean, it wasn't quite like Jim Edmonds completely over the shoulder, but it was still like he's diving backwards to get to that ball. And it was a fantastic catch. But what Bob said when he was looking from his vantage point behind home plate was the reason he probably got crossed up was because that ball was tailing off the bat.
Yeah, it had a slice to it.
So extremely, yeah. And he probably just read it incorrectly immediately. Yeah.
And then the ball started to slice the other way, and he was turned the wrong way.
And then realized, oh, geez.
Yeah. But what it did show, you know, was just some incredible foot speed, flat-out foot speed, and really nice athleticism to literally run probably 6, maybe 8 strides, turn the wrong way, full tilt, looking over your shoulder, and then dive and not fall on your face.
Yeah.
Make a fool out of yourself. I mean, that was the thing I kind of was watching. I was like, it looked like he was running the ball down, but it seemed so awkward. I was waiting for him to trip.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Get his feet crossed up.
But he did. So, you know, it showed that kind of like the question with Naquin, of course, is can he hit with enough authority to play a corner if he can't play center field defense? So that play, I guess, to me translates to he has the raw tools to stick in center. You know, maybe his footwork, his fundamentals are a little underdeveloped or still a little rough, but it's not like he doesn't have the foot speed or the athleticism to stick in center field.
Right.
I mean, that it was an amazing play. I think it still would have probably been an over the shoulder catch, but he made it just a hair harder than it needed to be because he was turned the wrong way. He couldn't quite run as fast as he was capable of.
Exactly.
We also saw Matt Packer continue a strong season for the Arrows. He pitched 7 innings Wednesday night against the Seawolves, gave up 3 hits and 1 run. His command kind of briefly evaporated. I think it was around the 4th inning, if not the 4th inning. It just lost. I mean, he all of a sudden, it was like ball 8, ball 9. Like,
right.
Nothing. But he only walked four total, so he did get out of that jam, and he recovered pretty well. I remember the next inning, it was just like, boom, strike right. one, strike two, like whatever that was gone. He's 11-8 on the year with a 3.14 ERA. We saw he doesn't throw real hard.
No.
He tops out at about 89.
Right.
But he had a nice breaking ball he kept dropping in that was in the 70s. So that's obviously his go-to weapon to set people up for that.
Now the next player that we saw, the one that you were excited about,
Trey Haley, who was touching 97 and 98.
This kid was nuclear
all the time. Yeah, which coming after Matt Packer must have just looked like holy.
That must have looked like a ping pong ball yeah. coming up there.
He had a walk where he kind of got himself in a little bit of trouble.
Right.
And of course, what you notice with a guy like that. Whenever the Seawolves made contact, it was loud
yep.
because when you got a guy like throwing 98, he's giving you all the power you need. If you just line it up, it's going
to
go.
Well, and the thing that I noticed, and it was tough to see. We actually touched on it. If you listen to the videos, you can kind of hear our dialogue while we're yeah. talking back and forth. And it's tough to see his delivery from where we were sitting down the first baseline. But you notice there's a distinct difference between how he delivers the ball when he's throwing a fastball versus
yeah.
when he throws a breaking ball. And one of the things you could tell from where we were sitting, though, was that his command and control were really, really lacking
yeah.
yesterday in that inning. He was everything was up. That's why those guys were making that good contact, because he was leaving everything up.
Right.
One, he sailed in the screen at Bob's, right at Bob's pumpkin, yes. at 97 miles an hour. That ball just ripping at
just
the screen.
Just went right over Jake Lowry's head.
Jake Lowry pops his mitt up there as fast as he can. He couldn't even get a mitt on it. So his command was lacking, and you're probably seeing that translate. I didn't look at his... at all of his numbers. You know, he's walking a ton of batters this year. He has
yeah.
almost as many walks as he does innings pitched.
I believe he's coming back. I think it's a shoulder injury.
Yeah.
So that may, you know, he may be kind of trying to find that release point.
Right.
Again, as he comes back from that.
They need to harness that control. That's
yeah.
Ricky Vaughn dangerous
yeah,
right
he's,
there.
He's got some smoke. There's no doubt about that. One guy we watched that I've heard a lot about, never saw him in person until last night, was Tyler Holt.
Yes.
He had three singles. He had a good at bat every time he was up. They've been playing him in left field for the first time lately, and he seems to be holding that down pretty well. It was interesting, though. I couldn't come up with the number off my head, if you remember, but he got on three times, and every time the Seawolves threw over probably six times before they'd throw a pitch, he stole 27 bases this year, and he stole 29 last year and 34 the year before that. So he's definitely got wheels.
He's got some value in those legs.
And James McCann was...
Poor James McCann. James McCann had such... Like, if you came to the ballpark to look at James McCann yesterday, left thinking, what's this schmuck doing behind home plate? And
yeah.
James McCann, he's a good defensive catcher. Traditionally, that's like James McCann's MO, is he's a solid
yeah.
defensive catcher.
The seventh inning kind of... It was seventh or eighth.
Where he let the ball through the wickets like twice.
Yeah.
And runners were scoring and advancing. And
then this wasn't him, but then the Seawolves threw the ball away on a rundown when they had a guy dead to rights. And
yeah,
it turned into Bad News Bears.
It was pretty Little League out there for a little bit.
Which I was hoping to see the Akron closer, but by the time that inning was over, there wasn't any
need for that anymore. No need for the bringing in the closer. Drew Verhagen was the pitcher that started yesterday. And Bob's been really excited to see Verhagen pitch. Didn't get to see him pitch for very long. He only threw four innings, but
yeah,
he still got to see that. So we're going to have those game recaps up there. We'll probably finish up the game recap from yesterday. Today, Jason and I are writing a combined article since we sat right next to each other and watched that game together yesterday at Jerry Yutz. So be on the lookout for that. That's up there. The other game recaps are already up there, so you can go check those out. Some with not so great quality video, but it'll get better as we start to tinker around with this a little bit more, us amateur minor league
yeah.
scouts. So.
And just because you said we're going to talk about Michael Brantley later, we were just saying as we watched Jesus Aguilar take long cuts.
Oh, that's, yeah, we needed to make sure.
Bad pitches that we just... would wish a guy like him would watch Michael Brantley swing
and take that approach,
and not all the time, because you know part of Aguilar's appeal is his ability to getting drive those arms the ball.
Extended, hitting the ball hard, right?
But when you're struggling, when someone is continually throwing you breaking balls.
Oh, he looks so stupid at those 75 mile an hour.
Shorten up, my man, and go the other way every once in a while, and they won't do it to you so much. He's
trying to mule hack that ball that was about to two bounce to the plate, just driving me crazy.
He is a man child. Wow.
Oh, he is large.
If you throw the ball anywhere within like a 50-foot radius of first base, he can get to it.
He's going to get to it. He's a big boy. Well, that's going to wrap it up for today. We'd like to again thank our listeners and ask if you're listening to us on iTunes that you give us a rate and review. If you want to, you can check us out on the internet at www.tsmbaseball.com. You can email us, tristatebb@tsmbaseball.com. You can follow us on the Twitter, @tristatebb. We're really active on Twitter, so go ahead and give us a follow. And you can check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/tsmbaseball. So, for Jason Ruggiero, this is Andy Burdick, and we look forward to talking to you next week.